politically, where does this end? One of the things that I think is terribly dramatic at this particular juncture in time is that there can be a political and a geographic closure enforced by the Israelis. But as you mentioned earlier, there can be a technological connection between Palestinians in diaspora for one of the first times in history vis-a-vis the internet. And that's pretty dramatic, and that creates a voice and a community, a virtual voice and a virtual community that couldn't coalesce before. And what does that mean, and how does that play out in the political spectrum?
If you're asking about possibilities,
are there possibilities here, or are we at a stalemate that's just impossible?
Well, what Palestinians are calling for right now are several things. One of them is that there's no return to Oslo as it was defined before, that there has to be a new framework in order to achieve a just peace. And that framework has to be based and located in international law, especially in the resolutions that call for Israel's full withdrawal to the Green Line, as they used to call it, the territories that it occupied in 1967. So that will mean dismantling settlements, you know, getting troops, settlers, everybody out. If that happens, then you'd have a two-state solution, which also has to take into account and implement the right of return of the Palestinians. There are 5 million Palestinian refugees around the world who originate in the areas which is now Israel and have a right to return home. Again, there's international law that calls for that. Palestinians demand that right be implemented. Now, whether all 5 million will go home or not is another issue. You know, many people are settled in other places and may not do so. And there's also the right to restitution, you know, the return of their property and compensation for what they lost since that time. So the thing is that what is on the table being offered, even in its best scenario, I mean, they've promoted Barak as being giving up so much. Even in, you know, Barak's so-called concessions, he and his government and whatever government comes into Israel does not see Israel fully withdrawing from these areas. They still see that the settlements, especially the settlement blocks, which are, you know, I don't know if you imagine settlements being on top of a hilltop, that's not it.
Right.
They're major cities, and they connect to, it's almost like you have, you know, connect the dots kind of thing. So you have huge parts of the West Bank and Gaza, which are, especially in the West Bank, which are really settlement blocks, which are supposed to be annexed into Israel. Israel says it will never give up East Jerusalem as its eternal unified capital. But, you know, when you talk about East Jerusalem, it's not the East Jerusalem that was occupied in 1967, but it's been expanded several times, incorporating areas that are really part of the West Bank and were not traditionally part of municipal East Jerusalem. I don't know what's going to happen. There, several things are sort of in the works here. One of them being the Palestine Authority would like to see a way out. Mm-hmm. And there's the fear that it will cave in to some deal, which is not going to be what I was just talking about. And that's going to be trouble. Even if the Intifada is quelled or quiets down for a bit, there's no justice, so there won't be peace. There's also, we're not getting enough news about it here, but there's also a lot of unrest in the Arab world and the surrounding Arab countries. The government so far, I mean, except for Egypt recalling its ambassador to Israel, and Morocco, Qatar, and some other country, I can't remember which right now, closed whatever diplomatic missions or offices or something like that. But apart from that, there's not been much reaction in the Arab world at the official level. At the popular level, there were demonstrations that had the participation of tens of thousands of people and hundreds of thousands of people in some cases. So there is a sense, a signal also to the Arab governments of be careful how far you go in trying to sort of navigate this place where you're not coming to the side of the Palestinian people, but you're also trying to send signals here. At some point, these governments may collapse. I don't know what it will take to do that. At some point, there will be popular pressure to change the policies. I don't know what it will take to do that. I think one of the things that has to happen for the Palestinians right now is international protection. They need some kind of force there to stop the settlers and soldiers firing on them, to remove the blockade against their communities, to allow food in, to allow medical care in. I heard just yesterday that 33 ambulances were destroyed, Palestinian ambulances. So for when the Israelis claim, oh, we don't shoot at ambulances, well, you know what, did the ambulances just blow up by themselves? So there also has to be a return. Palestinians are talking about internationalizing the problem, the mm-hmm. issue. For several decades now, the U.S. has elbowed out everybody else and acted as the only player. It calls itself the arms broker, but that's a big lie. And there now is a call to return the issue to the forum where it should be, which is the international community and international law. So I don't know where that's going to go. And the Palestinians in the territories are talking about continuing the Intifada and that they have a right to resist occupation in any means that they have to use, including whatever is going to happen in targeting the settlers and soldiers and driving home the idea that these people are occupiers and have to get out. It's hard to see where this is going to end. Some of the news these days is even talking about a regional war, that if provocations, so-called provocations by Hezbollah on the border, Israel will be forced to respond, which, you know, that's always the line, that it never acts offensively, it always acts defensively, and create a war with Lebanon. But of course, Lebanon is not the target, it will be Syria, and Syria is really the country that has not caved into Israel yet, unlike everybody else. So there could be a move to try to cancel out other regional players. I don't know where it's going to go, but I do know that if one good thing came out of the Oslo process for the Palestinians at least, it's a recreation of the Palestinian identity and Palestinian rights back to what had been lost in 1948, that the Palestinian problem is not about Ramallah or Hebron or getting a bit of land so that Arafat can set up an office. It is about the fundamental injury to the Palestinian people that was created 52 years ago by kicking them out of Palestine in the first place. And until that is acknowledged and addressed, regardless of Ramallah or Gaza City or anything else, there will not be peace. And that's a sad statement for Jews who've wanted to see in Israel a refuge and a sanctuary, but it's also strange that they don't become aware of this issue of how can you create a sanctuary on land that you stole from somebody else. And until they come to terms with that and find a way of living in equality with the people who were originally there and who are still there, there may not be peace.
It's always difficult to end on a note like that. But this is a terribly devastating situation. I'm wondering where the forces for peacemaking are at this point, and do you, in your work, do you see or groups coalescing, or even groups of small groups of individuals coalescing to create some sense or better sensibility that there could be an alternative to what's going on now?
Yeah, there are many, many fronts for that. In the territories, the groups that we work with have been working all along to try to create the basis for a democratic, participatory, equal society in Palestine, for men, for women, for everybody. So that has been the core of their work. Even if they're working on women's issues or workers' issues or human rights, the underlying agenda is that you can't have a free society until you have human resources and participation on an equal level. So that is one front of work. And obviously during this uprising, their agenda has been simply to meet the humanitarian needs, and the needs are obviously very desperate for medical care, for shelter, for protecting families, and so on. So that remains one front. There is also, on an international level, and here in the U.S., very active groups. I don't know in Lowell, but here in Boston, there are several groups that got together to form the Boston Coalition for the Protection of the Palestinian, for the Rights of the Palestinian People. And Grassroots International is part of that, as well as other organizations, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee and other groups, and a lot of individuals. So there's a very active coalition here that has put on these wonderful exhibits. Maybe one day you'll call them to Lowell, because they're doing, they're going around several universities, and now they have a list, a backup list of all the places they've been invited to, called Break the Silence, which is an exhibit. Pictures, poetry, showing the names of those who are killed, maps, statements from, there's a Jewish feminist group that's part of the coalition and has put out some statements, sort of a mock grave site. It's really set up so nicely to capture, without you know, chanting or slogans or demonstrating or anything. It's just an opportunity for people to walk through and absorb and experience the Palestinian reality. If delegations can't go there, you know, it's a way of bringing Palestine to the people and giving them a sense of feeling what it is to be in the situation. So there are those kinds of activists here, and there's a whole internet network that is very active in media. You know, you'll get a message, this article came out in the Boston Globe, respond, and then you'll have 50 people responding, writing a letter. Try to write an op-ed piece. Lobby, here's a resolution coming out of Congress. You know, call up your representative. For example, there's one right now about holding Palestinians responsible for terrorism that I can't remember the name of the resolution. It's going through the House right now. And so people are mobilizing to say this is unfair and imbalanced. So there is activism, and there's activism among a small group of organizations inside Israel, among Jewish groups. Most of the left, you know, has abdicated its role, but there are groups that are working, for example, against home demolitions, what they're calling the emerging apartheid, and protection, going into villages and places where Palestinians are being targeted and sort of placing themselves there, helping farmers to pick olives, demonstrating in Israel. There are women's groups as well as others that are doing that. And I think overall, and this will need some time to tell, but there are some groups, and not so much among our partnerships right now, or the groups that we support, because they simply want the occupation ended, and they want protection now, and they want removal of the blockade now. But as people are looking toward the future, down the line, and realizing that you can't separate these two peoples, and there are really three options. Either you're going to have permanent apartheid, where Israel is going to be the dominant, you know, nation, class, race, in all the area of Palestine, Israel. And it's going to be there in its presence as settlers and as, you know, residents within what is now Israel itself. So you're going to have permanent apartheid. Or you have to have a withdrawal, a real clear-cut withdrawal to the 67 lines with two distinct states, which is not going to happen because you have 400,000 settlers in the West Bank and you have, I don't know what, 20,000 or something, no, 6,000 in the Gaza Strip. So there's no way they're going to be removed. Maybe in the Gaza Strip, I don't know, but I can't imagine removing 400,000 settlers. So you're not going to have two states. And the final option would be one that hopefully Americans would support, which is a single state for Jews and Palestinians in all of Israel-Palestine. Where people would be equal, live in democracy, equality, human rights, everything respected. But for that to happen, I think it's going to take several generations and really needs a dismantling of the Zionist notion of this is Jewish land and the sense of entitlement that is associated with it. But that's very far down the road, and nobody wants to live with each other right now, especially under the circumstances that exist. But it is a Palestinian homeland. We're not giving it up, and I'm speaking as a Palestinian here. We're not giving it up. I'm not going to betray my own parents and say, yes, some Jewish person in Jaffa, which is where my parents come from, are more entitled to that homeland than I am or than my parents are. But for the time being, there needs to be protection for the Palestinian people. There needs to be some withdrawal of this occupation, and there needs to be a respect for the right of return. And these are the kinds of things that are the organizations that we're supporting are calling for in the short term. And the long term, it's still a long struggle ahead.
Seems like what you're saying is that this is a high tension situation. Obviously well more than that, but that it's not going to be solved on the ground in Israel, that as inextricable as the Palestinians and Israelis are, we live in a global climate. We live in a day of constant international politics. Where do we go from here?
Well, I think you're right, and I think that there may be an imposed peace which could come from basically the main power broker, which is the U.S., but in as far as the U.S. is on Israel's side, it's not going to be a just or a lasting peace. One would think that because of the global environment that you're talking about, that there'd be interest in settling this issue in a way that it doesn't keep erupting, simply to provide the climate for, you know, smooth process of globalization, if you happen to favor that. But and I think this is part of the impetus behind the U.S. role. Sort of settle it. The Palestinians don't count. Israel has the technology, the capital, etc., and just try to shove it down the Palestinians' throat. But it's not going to work. I think that maybe just the more encouraging aspects of this is just that it's helping to mobilize a community of caring and concerned and committed people to realize that what's going on in Palestine really needs to be addressed in a different way than it has been so far. So it's drawing in people who have an investment and commitment to this issue, which is helpful and good. And where it should be taken, I think, is not away from the U.S. and into the international community where it belongs. And if that happens, it could also, again, give a boost to this idea that we live in a world where we're all connected and we all have a stake in each other's well-being and peace and security. But that has not happened so far.
Thank you so much for illuminating this horrible and dramatic issue. I appreciate your time. One place to go for more information on the Intifada and on the work of Grassroots International and the work of its partner organizations is the Grassroots International website. And I'm wondering, Saad, if you could give us that URL.
Yes, it's www.grassrootsonline.org, which is one word, .org. So that's www.grassrootsonline.org. And on we have the information on all our programs, but on our Palestine page, we also have our partners, the organizations that we support, all listed, and some of them have their own websites, so you can get links to various places. And it also has information on what you can do, writing to the media, being active, if you care to participate and donate to our programs and help people on the ground there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.